Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price, joined, as always, every time and never not, by Chad Bird. Chad, how's it going?
Hey, Dan, it's good. It's good. Feels like it's been, what, has it been 2 weeks? Something like that since we delved in?
Well, here's a sneaky thing. It's been 2 weeks since me and you sat down and did this. It's not been 2 weeks since people listened because we were a week ahead.
Now we are a week ahead. That's kind of nice to have one in storage and ready to go, right?
Yeah, that episode in the oven is good to have, but we don't have it any longer. So now we're just, but it was good to have, so people didn't miss a week because I got sick, almost died, not really, but felt like I was gonna, and so we couldn't do it because I literally could not talk.
That's not very helpful when you're podcasting.
Hey, dude, I will fight through some illness to do this stuff. But when it comes to podcasting, the one thing you can't fight through is, sorry guys, I cannot speak.
I cannot talk. Yeah.
I'm glad you're
better. Glad to be back at it.
Yeah, dude, it's been just like 40 minutes of me nodding at you, you talking. I mean, maybe that'd be better. People have been like, dude, that would have been a much better podcast.
Oh, no, conversation is always better. I'm sure people talk to us. We just can't hear them.
That's true. They're yelling at us.
Like adding things along while we're talking, asking questions while we're talking. So it's a large conversation that takes place.
Probably. They're probably yelling at us. They're probably like, as we're working through, they're like, come on, Chad, pull it together, man. Like, I can't
sure
believe you're missing this.
That. I'm sure there's a few.
So where did we end off, man? Do you remember?
We sort of left Israel in the middle of the sea, actually, is where we are. We're in the middle of chapter 14 of the Exodus, one of the most astonishing chapters and insightful chapters in the whole Bible. So I guess that's where we need to dive right back into the middle of the Red Sea and see what happens to Israel and to Egypt, because both are central characters in this story.
Hey, man, you know what? I'm all about that Red Sea. And you know who else is all about that Red Sea? Is Israel is all about that Red Sea. Much like the Passover is sort of this big-time moment, right? Like in sort of Israel's history that they commemorate it every year, this sort of thing, right? It becomes this staple. I don't think there is anything more sung about that infiltrates like the Jewish worship as you read the rest of the New Testament, particularly if you go to the Psalms, you go to the Jewish hymnal, you have the deliverance from Egypt, and then you've got lots of straight up references to the Red Sea, like all over sort of their hymnody, if you will. This becomes sort of this put a pin in it moment in history where they know hey, we belong to God, remember the Red Sea.
Yeah, I don't have any stats here, but I know the Psalms pretty well, and I would venture to guess that there is, besides creation, there is no other historical event that is referenced more than the crossing of the Red Sea,
right,
in the Psalms of Israel. It really becomes the creation, which interestingly has to do with water, and the crossing of the Red Sea, which of course is another liquid moment in God's saving plan. Both of those together are sort of the dual center around which a lot of the hymns of Israel circle. So yeah, I mean, it really does. And I want to talk more about this in a few minutes once we finish the chapter, but it really does become kind of the foundation for almost everything that happens after Israel, the way they understand themselves, the way they understand God. And then it bleeds over into the New Testament, as we'll also talk about, in our understanding of how God saves and how he works in baptism, and even how the last day is already prefigured in this moment in the sea. So, you know, there's a whole lot that that is a is it's kind of a growth out of this chapter. It is really inexhaustible in its various kinds of theological implications that it has.
Yeah. I got thoughts, but I'm going to hold on to them. But I want you to put a pin in that thought of this being referenced over and over and over again, and it being sort of this pivotal moment in the life of basically every Israelite from that time forward for generations and generations and still today.
Yeah, let's put that pin there. We'll finish the chapter just to kind of get the whole story, and then we'll go back and talk about those things, because we're really not that far from the end. I think we left off in our discussion of the various verses around verse 24 or something like that. So as far as what's happening, Israel, of course, was trapped there on the shore. Moses held the staff over the sea. God caused this strong wind to blow, which parted the waters. Israel is passing through. They got a wall of water on their left and a wall of water on their right. And about at this point, as they are passing through the sea, the Egyptians decide, a very foolish decision, by the way, but the Egyptians decide that they are going to pursue them right into the middle of the sea. So you got verse 23, that the Egyptians took up pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen. So all the king's horses and all the king's men, they go after them into the midst of the sea. And then we kind of have this pause in the story. It says in verse 24, that it came about in the morning watch. So this is like the last few hours of the night, from like, I don't know, 2 o'clock to 6 o'clock, something like that. The last watch of the night, that God looks down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud. So you had this image. We met this pillar of fire and cloud earlier at the end of chapter 13, that led Israel up to this point. So Yahweh is still in this pillar. It's like he's clothed with this pillar of fire and cloud. He's there, but he's wrapped in the mantle of this pillar. And he looks down on the army of the Egyptians, and he throws them into confusion. There's a few different ways that you could translate the Hebrew here, but it's something like he caused their chariot wheels to get stuck or to swerve or something like that. Anyway, he messed with their chariot wheels. However he did it, he messed them up so that they couldn't drive them anymore. It's like they got stuck, or they came off, or whatever happened. Their wheels weren't working the way that wheels were supposed to go. And the Egyptians at this point, of course, they're stuck in the middle of the sea. They got walls of water on their left and right, and they're stuck. They can't get out. And it's at this point that they say, this is them speaking. They say, "Let us flee from Israel, because Yahweh is fighting for them against the Egyptians." As if they didn't realize it to this point, or didn't want to acknowledge it. I mean, they had seen the 10 plagues. They knew what Yahweh had done for his people. I mean, they're right in the middle of a sea that God has divided for them. But it's like, not until they finally get into the belly of the beast and God messes with their war implements, that they finally realize that all hope is lost, because not only have they been pursuing and fighting against Israel, but in fact, now Israel's God, Yahweh, is fighting against them.
See, that's crazy right there.
Yeah, that is crazy. That's a crazy moment for Egypt. I mean, they're confessing the truth that is their own undoing.
Yeah, dude. I mean, like, post 10 plagues, you know, some crazy plagues that went down. And then, like, your chariot wheel stuck in a seabed. And you're like, turn to your buddy and you're like, "Bro, it appears that God is on their side."
You know, it's just dawned on me.
You know,
that God is fighting against us.
This is it. This is, you know what? You know, I was undecided before, but I feel like it's safe to say at this point that there is something else at work here.
Yeah. You know, it really is a testimony to the stubbornness of the enemies of God to admit, to confess the truth about him, that only in the most dire of straits, or only when destruction is just about to hit, will they finally acknowledge that they are fighting against God and God is fighting against them.
Dude, you gotta have like a strong delusion on you. Okay. Straight up, if me and you are chasing like somebody, like say they like snatched your wife's purse, and me and you are chasing him, and he like runs up to like the ocean and parts it and it just starts running through it. There is no chance that I like no matter how much you beg. You'd be like, let's go, Dan. Be like, dude,
we got this.
There is no chance I'm going in there. No way, dude. That's it. Like that game over, right? As soon as the sea parts, I'm like, I'm out.
Sorry, I'm just gonna have to let the purse go.
I'm out, man. Like I'm no way I'm going down there.
Well, I think this is a symptom of the hardening of hearts that took place too.
Well, yeah,
they're going into death itself, they still go against Israel.
Yeah, I don't think this is just a matter of like, well, Pharaoh said to do it, so you got to do what Pharaoh says. I don't think it's that. I think this like shows you that if Pharaoh is representative of all of the Egyptian, the entirety of the Egyptians. I don't think it's just strictly Pharaoh who has his heart hardened here, but like it appears that these are some hard-hearted people, because I don't care who you are. Yeah, you're not going to do that. Like, I mean, your commander could be like, go in there and do that. And you're going to have a number of dudes that are going to be like, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is kind of a mass hardening that's taken place over the whole Egyptian army. And I mean, it's really an insightful picture into the way that evil eventually is destroyed. And this is kind of the meta story, if you will, of this whole individual story, is that evil is destroyed by pursuit of God in an attempt to destroy him. And in that very pursuit of destruction, evil is destroyed. It's the same thing, of course, that happens with Jesus. The devil thinks that he has won by pursuing God all the way to the cross. And then it's on that very cross that evil is destroyed. Death thinks it has destroyed God by killing him and burying him, and yet it's in that very death and burial that death is destroyed. So you have these symbols of evil and of sin, personification of the devil, if you will, in Pharaoh and in his army, pursuing the people of God, and in that very pursuit they themselves are destroyed. That's the way that God works. He brings his people to the point where it seems that they themselves are going to be destroyed. And yet what happens is he ends up destroying evil in order that he might save his people. So they realize God's fighting for them. And God says to Moses then to put his hand back over the sea. And the waters come back on the Egyptians, their chariots and their horsemen. And it says that the Egyptians, while they were fleeing right into the sea, that the Lord overthrew them in the midst of the sea. The Hebrew word na'ar is used there. My translation is the Lord overthrew the Egyptians. But literally, it's the idea of shaking off. It's kind of like you have, you know, you've got these, I don't know, you got ants that are crawling on something, and you shake it, and they all fall off into the water. That's the image that's conveyed by the Hebrew verb there. He shakes them off into the midst of the sea, and there they drown. The waters engulf them, and it says not even one of them remained, which is important because this is not the other plagues were to some extent restrictive. They only dealt with some of the people, or even the tenth plague, only killed some, the firstborn of the Egyptians. But this one is a total destruction of the enemies of God and of his people. So not even one of them remained. Then it kind of wraps up, to kind of wrap up the chapter. It says, the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea with these walls to their left and right. And it says in verse 30, the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Let me say a couple things about the way this wraps up, and then we'll go back and talk about some of these bigger issues. So these last two verses, you've got everything kind of pulled together here. You got your two main parties, Israel and Egypt. It's mentioned there's in these last two verses, Israel's mentioned three times, and the Egyptians are mentioned three times. So you got these paired together, and a threefold mentioning of them to kind of pull the whole story together. Israel and Egypt. Israel representing the people of God, and then Egypt representing everything that is anti-God and that is anti his people. And it says the people, when they had seen what God did, they feared him, they believed in him, and in his servant Moses. I love the fact that faith, it says they feared and believed, that their fear and their faith result from seeing what God has done on their behalf. So by understanding that God has worked to save them, to destroy their enemies, on the basis of what God has done, they fear and they believe in him. So faith is not just kind of simply a plunge into the unknown. You know, the step into an unknown darkness. Faith is based upon knowledge of what God has done for us in saving us. So our faith is not just kind of this, like sometimes we'll talk about faith, you know, this just leap into whatever. No, faith is not based upon that. Faith is based upon knowledge and trust in what God has done for us in Christ. Just like the faith of the Israelites was based upon what God did for them in saving them from the Egyptians at the Red Sea. And not only did they believe in the Lord and in what he had done, but they also believed in his servant Moses. So there's this idea that by virtue of God's saving activity, the people believe in him, but they also believe in the one that he has sent to be their leader, to guide them, to be God's mouthpiece for them from this moment onward. So Moses himself is given credence and he's given authority, not based upon what he's done, but based upon the fact that God has used him as the human instrument to bring about this deliverance at the Red Sea. So that's the end of the chapter. Lots of good stuff that's there. I'm sure there's things that you want to talk about, Dan. Let me kind of start us out with something we've touched on before, but I don't know that we explicitly looked at it. And that is that when the New Testament reads the story of the crossing of the Red Sea, it reads that story in connection with baptism. This is from 1 Corinthians 10. Paul is leading up to his discussion of the Lord's Supper and related matters, but this is the way he starts out 1 Corinthians 10. He says, I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Then he goes on, and all ate the same spiritual food, and all ate the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from the spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Now, what he does there, what Paul does there, is he's reading this Old Testament story through New Testament eyes. So he's saying to the people that he's writing to the Corinthians as well as to us, that when you read Exodus 15 or 14, read that with the understanding that what God was doing there is the same thing that he does in our midst today. Just like he saved Israel through the water and through the one that he had sent to bring them out of slavery and into liberation, so he does the same thing for us. They were baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea, just like we are baptized into the new and the greater Moses, Christ, who has brought us through the water of baptism into freedom and into salvation via his cross and resurrection. So if you think about baptism as having a twofold nature, you're going to have kind of the whole picture of what God does in baptism and then how that connects with the Red Sea, because we tend to think of God's work in baptism in connection with his saving activity, which is true. But the flip side of that is that God also destroys in baptism. So baptism is also a violent act. When you look at baptism from the perspective of the Red Sea, you see that what God does to the Egyptians, what he does to Pharaoh, what he does to these forces of evil in destroying them and drowning them in the water is the same thing that he does in baptism. So in baptism, what God does is he takes the old Adam, he takes our sinful nature, he takes death, he takes every aspect of evil which we have inherited from Adam and which we have added to that, and he plunges it under the water of the Red Sea, this Red Sea baptism that we are undergoing, and he drowns it. It's a violent, destructive, death-dealing act. That is the one side of baptism. So God does destroy in baptism, just like he destroyed at the Red Sea. But he destroys in order that he might save and recreate. There could be no salvation for Israel without the simultaneous destruction of Israel's enemies. Salvation, it means being saved from something, and that something from which we are being saved needs to be destroyed. So God destroys our sinful nature. He drowns it in order that he might recreate us and reform us in the image of Christ, so that when we emerge from the waters, we emerge as a new creature, as one who has passed through the water of our Red Sea baptism and emerge on the other side as those who are recreated, remade, who are saved from all the stuff that is now at the bottom of the Red Sea of baptism. And I think when you look at baptism from the perspective of this Old Testament narrative of the crossing of the Red Sea, it gives you a bigger picture of exactly what God is doing there. He's not just saving you, but he's saving you by destroying that which would have been your death.
Yeah, there's this awesome thing where speaks of it, because this language might be kind of weird to someone where you're like, hold up, what do you mean baptized into Moses? But all this is really saying is that they are baptized into their deliverer. I mean, this is what Moses is, right? He's the deliverer that God sent, and so if you look at it that way, like, yes, but we are baptized into the one sent to save us. We're baptized into our deliverer. And what's, you know, all the way back to that initial point that we were talking about, this becomes then this pivotal moment. Like, and this is very much the Jewish identity. Like, we're those who passed through the Red Sea, right? Like, that's who we are. And so as this becomes the thing that they sing about and the thing that they identify themselves with, likewise, at least this should be this way. I mean, this is why Paul brings it up, like, over, like, almost in every letter to different churches, he will reference their baptism. He does it in Colossians and Romans and Galatians and 1 Corinthians over and over and over again. He talks about this. It's in Ephesians, if you know where to look. That your identity then, much like the Israel's identity are those who were baptized in the Red Sea, that God brought through the Red Sea, and that the horse and the rider were thrown to the sea and destroyed forever. Your identity then, this sort of pinnacle moment in the Christian life, is the one of baptism. Like, you are the baptized. That's who you are. You are the ones who have been baptized into Christ. You are baptized children of God. There's this cool phrase when you have a Christian who's wandering off. There's I can't even remember who it is that first said this, but I love it. And he steals it from Paul, because he says this is what Paul does over and over again in his epistles. But he says he tries to grab them by their baptism, which I like, because I do
think that's a great image.
Yeah, I do think that's what Paul is doing a lot of the time. So instead of trying to grab them by something else, grab them with the law or something like that, instead he's like, hey, I mean, you see this in Corinthians, jacked up church. I mean, like the worst church you ever thought of. Okay, like, you never been to a church that was more jacked up than the church in Corinth. And like, and he does, he says, he's like, hey, you guys are baptized. What's going on? Like, what is this? Like you're baptized. That's grabbing them by their that's grabbing them by their identity, saying like, hey, you know, this is you, right? Like, this is the moment. And like, and this is why, like, I love hymns that incorporate, terms like baptism or washing and things like that, because I think there's biblical precedent, when you look at the sort of things that the Israelites sang about. This is a definitive moment, a defining moment in who they are. And it wasn't as though, like, oh, this happened and then we just forget about it. No, this happens and like, now we're going to sing about it for generations. Well, this didn't just happen to your ancestors a long time ago and you get to sing about it. This sort of, the God takes the Red Sea and like puts each and every one of you through it. And so this becomes something that, honestly, I would like to hear us sing about more. I think I wish there was more of baptism in our hymnody. I mean, there's some, because I think that that's exactly how it was for the Jews. It becomes a thing. And so, that's it sounds weird, but baptized is who you are. Like the Jews are, they are the ones who like were brought safely through the Red Sea.
You know, that's why, we haven't got to it yet. We will next time, but that's why, immediately following this, in chapter 15 is a song. It is a hymn. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just kind of recount what happened, but it does much more than that. Well, of course, I don't want to get too far ahead. We'll get to that. We'll get to that in the next episode. Talk all about the song at the sea, but it's very significant, and it dovetails exactly with what you were saying, Dan, that the hymns that flow from this act are numerous, and they really set the identity of Israel for all generations. So who is Israel? Well, they are the people that God brought out of Egypt and through the Red Sea into the Promised Land. That's who they are. And their identity, I love this aspect of it too, their identity then is based upon not some moral achievement or some victory which they were able to gain through military might or through careful human planning, but their identity is based completely upon God's action for them. So he's the one who parted the waters. He's the one who destroyed their enemies. He's the one who brought them safely through the waters of the sea. And so this then becomes the way they understand themselves, what they sing about, the way that they see who they are in the eyes of God. And as such, becomes exactly then the same for us in baptism. It's not just an act in the past, but it becomes the moment which defines all our moments. So when we are baptized, when we cross our own Red Sea, that defines who we will be for forever, really. We are those who are washed into Christ Jesus, those who are saved from sin, death, and the devil, those who are brought forth into a new creation.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you see this in Revelation when you're like, when straight up the question is asked, so who are these guys? It's like, it's those who have been, whose robes have been washed white, right? I mean, like, this is, mm-hmm. I mean, that's who you are, like, forever in heaven. I mean, so just as God pulls Israel out of the slavery of Egypt, washes them in the Red Sea and takes them to the Promised Land, there is a 40 years in the wilderness thing that we all go through there, but it's just like that for us. He pulls us out of slavery to sin, death, and the devil, baptizes us into our deliverer. We struggle through life as God's baptized people, but eventually he the end goal is what he does there, and he will take us to the promised land of a new heavens and new earth and a good forever. I mean, that's I mean, like, the whole redemptive narrative is sort of like right here in the Exodus. I mean, this is what, if you want to know what the Bible's about, you can sort of just read like these two chapters and know, like, yeah, this is what it's about. It's about God. A lot of times you get this twisted. Like, it's not even like really about like God doing things through you. It's about God doing things for you and to you. So he delivers you, unites you with Christ at baptism, guides you through this wilderness of life, providing for you all along the way. And we'll get there with manna and life-giving water from the rock of Christ, eventually to get you to that good everlasting promised land of the new creation. That's what's up. That's the whole Bible condensed down to, I mean, that Exodus is the whole Bible.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. It's the Bible in miniature right there. You know, I, as you were talking, I was reminded of another aspect of this, especially with the whole new creation imagery. And that is that when John in Revelation 21, so the next to last chapter in the whole Bible, when he talks about the new heavens and the new earth, one of the things that he mentions is that there is no longer any sea. This is the beginning of Revelation 21. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. Now, that I remember years ago reading that for the first time and being struck by that and wondering why in the world that was added by John. I mean, you got a new heavens and a new earth. Why would there not be a sea? The old heavens and the old earth, they had plenty of seas. And over time, I came to realize it, especially through studying the Old Testament, passages like the one we're looking at now, is that for the Old Testament people, when they thought of the sea, they didn't think of some kind of calm waters, you know, a nice vacation spot on the beach. For them, the sea was symbolic of evil and of chaos and of confusion and of the forces of evil that God overcame on their behalf. It's not just, it certainly is here with the crossing of the Red Sea, but you already see this in the beginning. One of God's first acts was to demonstrate that he holds the authority over water, because he splits the waters in half. He separates the waters above from the waters below, and then later he'll split the waters again, and he'll make water stay over here, and then he has dry ground, and he won't let the border between those two be crossed. So God is always the God who subjugates the power of water. He's the one who rules over the swelling of the seas, as one of the Psalms talks about. Psalm 46, that has that verse about "Be still and know that I am God," talks about how there's the roaring of the waves, the roaring of the seas, the sounds of many waters. So, for the Old Testament, in the Old Testament imagination, and really in the biblical imagination, the seas are not a place of repose and calm and peace, but instead of evil and of chaos and confusion that God must overcome. And so when you have a new heavens and a new earth where there is no longer any sea, that's the biblical way of saying that in this new heavens and new earth, there is calm. There's not chaos. There's peace. There's not warfare. There's salvation. There's no need for destruction anymore. So when you read stories like the crossing of the Red Sea, you got to read this not just in isolation, but in view of the whole biblical story as well. That this account of these violent waters is God's way, and God's victory by means of and over these violent waters is also a way of his pointing toward to the end times. Is in some ways you could say that the crossing of the Red Sea is a preview of the eschaton, of the last days, when God will vanquish all evil by means of water, and then will create a new heavens and a new earth where there will no longer be any chaos or any confusion or any death.
Yeah, I think that it's also there's obviously so in Genesis you have God creating everything kind of from water, forms everything out of water. Then you have him recreating people through the waters of baptism, and the new heavens and the new earth. The creation is done, and recreation is done. So there is no you. While your identity in the new creation is one of one who has been baptized, there is no baptism going on in the new heavens and new earth. There is no more creation going on or recreation going on. This is like the forever eighth day, and so. It's where this weird thing where like water is no longer necessary. Like, since God creates and recreates using water, it sort of speaks to the finality of the new heavens and the new earth, that there forever, there will never again be a cause to create or recreate anything. That this final word of this is very good remains. It does not get destroyed. There will be no need to baptize anything. That everything will remain good. And so because that water is the element that God uses for that, right? This is what he creates things out of, but God no longer will have need of it, which is great. So it speaks to the finality of the goodness and the final destruction of sin, that there'll be no need to wash anything. Everything will be pure. No need to create anything. Everything will be created, and no need to recreate anything because nothing will be fallen.
Yeah. You know, I think this, as far as like kind of looking at how all these narratives fit together, I think this also gives us an insight into what happens with Christ and his apostles as they are crossing over the Sea of Galilee and storms come up.
Yeah.
I don't know if folks have looked at that story through this particular lens, but I think when you do, it gives you a greater insight into what's happening between Jesus and his disciples there. They're in the boat, a storm whips up the sea. Of course, the disciples are panicking. Jesus is asleep in the boat, and they wake him up. Lord, don't you care that we are perishing? So really what you have happening in that crossing of the Sea of Galilee in the midst of a storm is kind of all of these biblical stories coming together. I mean, you've got the creator in the boat, the one who overcame the chaos of the waters in the beginning, the one who brought Israel through the midst of the sea, and then who brought Israel later across the Jordan River, which we haven't talked about yet. The one who delivered Jonah from the sea. I mean, you got all these stories of God bringing about deliverance for his people in the midst of the waters of chaos. And here he is with his disciples on the boat in the storm, and he stands up and he says, "Be still." So by his word, he brings calm over these chaotic waters, and they cross from one shore to the other. So it's what Jesus is doing there is he's demonstrating by his actions that he's the creator, come to his creation to bring peace in the midst of chaos by means of water and word, and to bring his people then safely across to where he wants him to be. It's all kind of implicit in that story, but when you see that story in connection with all these other biblical stories, then it becomes clear exactly what Christ is doing there.
Yeah. One of my favorite Jesus in a stormy sea things actually in Mark, where the disciples are in the boat and things are getting crazy, and the sea's all whipped up in a frenzy, and it says Jesus on a mountain. And it says that he looks down and sees them perishing. And so, I mean, like, there's this beautiful gospel thing where they're like, they're in the sea, they're going to die, and here's Jesus on a mountain, and he has to condescend. He descends down and comes walking across the water, like, just like strange. A boss.
Yeah.
it's amazing, because, like, that's how it goes. You're like, we're all going to die. We're all going to die, and God looks down from heaven and says, "Guess I'm going to have to come down and like a champ and just like walk right on top of this."
Oh, that's great. That is great. Yeah.
That's all the time.
Oh, that's it.
That's it, dude. That's it. We could talk. I feel like we could talk about water narratives for days and days.
Yeah, we could. We could. Well, it's just what you can hardly open up a page of the Bible without getting wet. I mean, it's all over the place.
That's so. Right. That's one of our main objectives.
It lends itself to lots of stories.
Yeah, it's one of our main objectives is to teach you to read the Bible without the common evangelical dehydrated hermeneutic.
There you go.
So the scriptures are wet, brother. All right, guys, thanks so much for tuning in. Go over to the iTunes, rate and review, share this podcast. Go over to ChristOldFast.org, check out the events that we got going on. We got one coming up in Detroit May 6th, and we got a huge event that you don't want to miss coming up in San Diego in October to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. You are running out of time to get in on the early bird. That early bird price ends at the end of this month. So if you haven't done it and you've just been putzing around, it is go time. It is go time. So go over there. You can also go to herewestillstand.com and get all the information. Me and Chad will both be there. We want to see you. We want to hang out. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.